You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 24th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Trudy Lieberman of the Columbia Journalism Review on her piece in Harper's Magazine on the coverage and the, I guess, failed promise of the Affordable Care Act. Also on the program today, remember that big announcement about the big change in the drone policy? Where the program would come out of the shadows, no longer under the province of the CIA, but rather in the under the military's watchful eye, so that it has some measure of accountability. And, well, yeah, forget about that. We decided, whoop, I'm not going to do that. Also on the program today, I know this is going to be difficult for some to accept. Homegrown radicals more deadly than jihadis in this country. And I can assure you folks, when I say homegrown radicals, I'm not talking about eco or vegan terrorists. And congratulations to you CEOs out there. You're making 303 times more than your workers. 303. Autopsy results from the Freddie Gray autopsy have been leaked. They confirm what a lot of people suspect in terms of how he received his fatal injuries. And ladies and gentlemen, it is now minute 23 of Sarah Palin's 15 minutes of fame. Alas, we hardly knew you. Well, actually, we did know you. And Chris Christie and Bobby Jindal announced that they're going to announce that they are going to enter into the Republican sweepstakes for president in 2016. And no word as to whether or not Chris Christie is going to run on the plank. There is room enough for two indicted candidates for the Republican presidency. We'll see. I mean, he has to differentiate himself in some way. And now that Trump is there, having taken that sort of blowhard slot and doing it, frankly, with all due respect to Chris Christie, and I mean that facetiously, with all due respect to Chris Christie, doing it better than Chris Christie, far more popular. Like I mentioned yesterday, Donald Trump, number two in polls in New Hampshire, number two.
People love me.
People love him. It's true. I love him. I'm enjoying this more than anything. But we will get to all of that today. Folks, Request. It is Wednesday, and that is the day that we make the special request for you to go over and give us a review on iTunes. You can review our app, which you can also get for free at majorityapp.com, or go to iTunes, give us a review. It helps get the show out there. It helps market the show. Our marketing budget is small. It is somewhere between zero and zero. So we rely on you to spread the word about our program. Still waiting for the reply. My dad called me the other day when he heard that Mark Maron was going to interview Obama. And my father said, you should write to Obama and see if he'll come on. And so I sent the letter.
Dear Mr. Obama.
Dear Mr. President. Please come on my program. Love, Sam Cedar. And I just wrote the White House, North Pole, on it and put it in the mail. And that was basically it.
Dear Sam, thank you for your letter. No.
All right. Well, now, wait. We don't know. We don't know yet. We'll see. But
Barack.
Assuming the president does not accept my invitation to come on this program, we will need to rely on you folks and your reviews and iTunes. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk to Trudy Lieberman. Interesting piece. It is we are on the eve of the King versus Burwell case, which could, at the very least, seriously hamper a large part of the Affordable Care Act in a large number of states. And opportunity to look back, see how the Affordable Care Act is doing in general, and if it's living up to its promises, be they as they were. We'll be right back with Trudy Lieberman. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the contributing editor at the Columbia Journalism Review and writer of a piece that is out in Harper's. You need to have a subscription to Harper's Magazine, as I do. Not terribly expensive, certainly worthwhile. The piece is entitled Wrong Prescription, The Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. Trudy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I got to tell you, like, I have such a weird, I guess, perspective, but sort of feeling around this, because there are so many competing narratives out there about the Affordable Care Act and how it's doing. And I find it very hard. And I have read so much on what the status is of the Affordable Care Act. And of course, we're on the eve of the King v. Burwell case, which may have its own implications. But give me a sense, and I know you've been writing about this from even prior to it being genuinely debated in the Democratic primary 6-8 years ago now.
Right.
But give me a sense of why you're writing this piece now.
Well, I think there's just been so much misinformation about the law, both on coming from the right and coming from the left, so to speak. And I think the American public does not have a clear idea about this law, what it does not do. And there's a lot of mythology that's been built up on it by both sides. And it's been very difficult, I think, to for a lot of people to kind of break through that and sort of look at what's really happening. I had an email yesterday from a reader of the piece in Harper's who is a former corporate lawyer who's retired now, and he's been working with some of the advocacy groups. And he said it's been so difficult to even deal with people in those communities because you can't say anything negative or even question anything about what the law might not be doing. So what I did in the Harper's piece, and because as you noted, I've seen it all from the very beginning and before, going way back to the Clinton plan in the early 90s, so I have a fair grasp of what's going on. I just sort of looked at it objectively right down the middle and looked at what some of the issues really are with this law.
Before we get into the issues with the law, let's talk a little bit about the coverage, because obviously, you know, coming from the Columbia Journalism Review, you're not only writing about the healthcare law, but you're writing about how the healthcare law is being written about. And just the other day, we had the story in the New York Times, and there was another story. I think we spoke to, I think it was Stephanie Menemser, about some of the other plaintiffs in this Halbig v. Burwell case. And it's quite clear that even the plaintiffs in this case at the Supreme Court, which could theoretically cost the insurance for, I don't know, around 5 million people, maybe six, that they don't even understand what the law is. Give me your sense of the way it's been covered.
Well, I would say not very well, and I have written about that extensively in hundreds of blog posts for the Columbia Journalism Review over the last 8 years. And what seemed to be happening is that there were reporters that were essentially cheerleaders for the ACA and did not always fully explain what was happening, because many of them were getting their information from groups that were very supportive of the law for their own reasons. And I think one example I can give you is this question of affordability. And many people who were thinking about this at the time, say in the middle of 2009 when the debate was hot and heavy, that there was going to be an affordability issue. And even for people who have subsidies or who were going to get subsidies, there was going to be an affordability issue. And it was very difficult for people to write about that. And I think I only found one reporter at the time for Kaiser Health News who was really looking at those subsidies and the indexing on them and whether they are going to be affordable and really help people as we go on. And I think in this last round of signups that we've had, the interest is that some of these policies really haven't been affordable for people. And in some states and overall, some people did not come back to the exchanges and re-up for next year. And California and New York are two states where that's an example, but that didn't happen. In California, the drop-off was larger than it was in New York. And what happened is that many of those people probably decided they couldn't afford it, even with the subsidy. And we have to remember that those subsidies decline the higher your income. So you may see a story that you can get a subsidy if you have income of 400% of the poverty level, which is for a family of four, something over $90,000, that, you know, you're going to get a subsidy for that. But in reality, they're not going to get much subsidy at all. They're going to be very, very minimal. And for people at the low end, we'll get a bigger subsidy, but what they seem to be doing is buying very inexpensive policies, and I use that in quotes, inexpensive relative to other policies that they could buy that are more expensive, and finding themselves with huge cost-sharing requirements, very large deductibles, very large co-insurance amounts, very high co-pays. And this is, of course, adding to their overall out-of-pocket costs, and you have to figure the whole range of costs that they assume. And I want to make a
I want to get into the specifics of that in a minute, because I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff here at once. I mean, just staying on for one moment in terms of the coverage, Who do you think has done? You said this one reporter from Kaiser Health News, at least, you know, sort of looked forward into the sort of the affordability. And it seems to me that I remember, and there's been some data. Well, I mean, there's been plenty of data that the cost of medical coverage and the cost of health insurance has not grown at the rate that it had before. It's not to say that it hasn't grown, but it hasn't grown at the same rate. And I just remember all this talk about bending the cost curve as opposed to, like, actually making the stuff cheaper. There's a difference there, right? Bending the cost curve just means it's not going to grow as quickly in expense as it has been. And to a certain extent, that's true, right? But at the end of the day, you can't take the savings that you would have had it grown faster. You can't take and spend that money. It doesn't exist.
Well, I think what the big failing here was not to look at what average families' budgets look like. And I think that you need to put yourself in the shoes of a family making $60,000. And that's something over the median income in this country, which is 53, 54, something right. like that. And when you look at the expenses that those families have, and then to shoehorn in a premium, say, of $300 for an individual or maybe $500 for a family, whatever it is, that's a lot of money to that family. And for people who have very high incomes in New York and Washington, where people are talking about this law and have pushed this law, that's, of course, nothing to them. But it is a lot of money to these people, irrespective of what happens to health care costs down the road. And I want to make one point about that, that the cost growth had slowed for a little bit over the last few years, but I was just speaking with insurance company actuaries yesterday, and those costs have started to go up again. And one actuary was telling me that they are predicting higher rates this year than they had seen last year in exchange policies. And that's what is called the medical trend, which is jargon for what the medical costs are, which, of course, is the bottom line. Those have started to rise again.
Okay.
So you're right. They slowed for a little while, and prices were still high for many people, and they are going to continue to rise, especially because of hospital costs and drug costs, which keep going up.
And so, okay, so let's move on. I mean, on some level, I feel like that was always it was the cost of these things, even though it was the Affordable Care Act, was always sort of dealt with as a bank shot in some ways. And just to touch on the signups, because that is sort of like, I guess, a data point as to whether or not people are feeling some form of sticker shock or just unable, I guess. Sticker shock is actually like a term of art, I guess, in the context of the Affordable Care Act. So I shouldn't use that per se, but that people are finding it too expensive. We don't, just to be clear, we don't have the data yet to know where those people went, right? The people who did not sign up, who had signed up last year through an exchange, but did not sign up this year. We don't know if they went and bought insurance somewhere else, or they said, forget it, I'll just take the penalty, or what, right? We don't know.
That's correct. Somebody needs to do a very thorough study of that. I think it's fair to assume that some of them might have gotten insurance from an employer or from a spouse. But I think that the people who've looked at this and the consulting firms have thought that many of them have found, especially at that middle income level, they may have decided the premium was too high for them.
And we'll know that theoretically at the end of the year, right, when people file their taxes.
Well, we'll know about the penalties at the end of the year, whether there's been an increase in people taking the penalties. I think we really don't have a good read yet on whether people are choosing to take penalties rather than sign up. I think there needs to be a few more years of experience. I do want to say that, in fairness, some people have gotten insurance, and they do find it very helpful. But I think that we haven't considered enough this high burden of cost-sharing that is coming with those policies. And I think that was not debated very much during the ACA.
Yeah, I mean, I I agree with that. I think we heard a lot about bending the cost curve. And again, that's not real money in your pocket. It's just sort of you're arguing against projections.
Exactly.
But on some level, I mean, and this is, you know, and again, I want to move to sort of the more substantive. Well, I'm not saying that the media coverage isn't substantive, but I want to move to the more actual sort of details of the Affordable Care Act in a minute. But the dilemma here, it seems like the argument was between people who were at best disingenuous about their interest in any type of reform of our healthcare system, and then people who were interested in reform to a certain extent. Like, you know, it seems to me that the debating about cost sort of got lost in a sort of sea of maybe sort of disingenuous intent in some respects.
Well, this law really did not have tough cost containment provisions in it, because in this country it's very difficult to do that. In the countries that have totally universal coverage and provide higher quality care in many instances, also spend less as a proportion of their GDP. And they do that because federal governments in those countries, or whichever government, pushes back against the power of the providers. And in this country, there really is not that kind of pushback, except somewhat in the Medicare program. And even in the Medicare program, while the cost of the program has come down because the cost to hospitals, or the prices that the government paid for services to hospitals, has been cut under the ACA, the hospitals are still pushing back now. They're saying, no, we don't want any more cuts, and they're, you know, taking steps to make sure that that doesn't happen. Instead, what the ACA did was bet on a number of more lukewarm measures, shall we say, to try to control costs. And I think while in themselves those might be very important measures as we go forward, health IT for one, these so-called accountable care organizations that are supposed to coordinate care better, they may actually do that and have benefits for the people who use them. But as far as overall, you know, huge amounts of savings and pushback against the providers, that's probably not going to happen. And I think we have to look at another trend that's just happening. It's in the news right now, is the mergers going on or contemplated in the health insurance industry. We may be at a place where there are two or three carriers and a few Blue Cross plans left in the market. And as most of us know, when markets consolidate, prices tend to go up because there are players big enough now to dictate the prices. So that is likely to happen in the insurance market, and I think it's going to take a few years before we know who's merging with who and all of that kind of gets sorted out. But I think looking down the road, that's an issue.
All right, let's go over, just so that we can give people, you know, do our part in just informing people about the sort of the at the very least, some of the broad strokes of the law. There are basically, it seems to me, there are two major aspects of the law: the private insurance industry and Medicaid expansion. I think people who listen to this program are very comfortable in understanding that there are and are aware that we're talking about at least, I think, about 7 million people have been added to the Medicaid rolls. It would have been closer, I think, to 11 if states controlled by Republican lawmakers had allowed for that Medicaid expansion. That's fairly accurate, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's a good thing. I mean, in some ways, a great thing. Right.
Well, I think the Medicaid expansion actually is the best part of the law. And as you can tell from reading my piece, I spent a lot of time looking at what that meant in Tennessee, a state that did not expand. And it's really very sad, almost pathetic, that those people who need help as much as those in a neighboring state that might, like Kentucky, that has expanded and can't get coverage, and they have really serious health problems, and they are just out of luck. They are very poor people generally. They have no money to buy a policy, and they're forbidden from buying a policy on the exchange and receiving a subsidy. And so that's, you know, if the law were going to be fixed, that's the first thing I think I would vote for. And maybe,
but when you say fixed,
upheld,
so essentially, so when you say fixed, expand the instead of it starting at 133% of poverty in terms of when the subsidies kick in, you would drop it down to essentially 100%, so that those people who did not get expanded Medicaid coverage in the states through a federal mandate on the exchanges would be eligible to subsidies in sort of like almost like a backdoor Medicaid.
I mean, I would think that would be one way you could do it. You could make them eligible for subsidies. Of course, there are cost implications for the federal treasury, and there might be a lot of opposition to that. And
there definitely would be total opposition to it, I think. I mean, at least in on a federal level, there's no way. I mean, we can agree that what we're talking about now is when we start talking about fixes to this law, we're talking about a world where there is no Republican Congress. And then even then, that's when the debate starts, right? I mean,
well, yes. I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult to fix it, and I think everybody is in pretty much agreement on that point. But there is an easy fix if there were a will to do it politically, which we agree there is not.
Right.
But that would be an easy fix. But in the meantime, there are 4 or 5 million people out there who really have no options. And what that does is further the inequities that we have in the U.S. healthcare system.
So
these people are just in need of care as anybody else is.
Indeed. I mean, very well, the easiest of all fixes would be for the governors of those states to say, you know what, I'm going to be a human being. I mean, John Kasich, I guess, apparently was just at a Koch brothers funded retreat and basically said to one potential donor, why did you expand Medicaid? And he said something to the effect of like, well, because I don't want God to judge me for basically screwing over poor people, which...
In Tennessee, the governor was in favor of it. He just couldn't bring the legislature along.
So there you have it. But all right, so let's move into the exchanges, because when we talk about this is one of the things that I think, you know, I began to understand when we were talking about the sort of failure of the rollout of the website and the actual exchanges themselves, was that when we talk about the exchanges, I mean, the Affordable Care Act impacts, I think, about 14 million people directly, more or less, right? In the expansion of Medicaid. And then if they are involved with the exchanges, the rest of us, the only difference is that is a regulatory structure. Is that accurate?
The rest of us who have insurance?
Yeah. In other words, we're no longer subject to rescission. Or my 26-year-old son or daughter can be on my plan up until age 26, or I can't be denied for pre-existing conditions. That's, you know, for those of us who are not buying on the exchanges, those, because the vast majority of people either have employer-provided health insurance or union-provided health insurance, The vast majority of Americans are implicated only by those sort of those regulations in terms of their insurance. Yes.
Yes, that's right.
And so we're talking about 5 or 6, 7 million people, and I think that's one of the flaws of the Affordable Care Act is that we're not talking about 30 million people, right? Which was ostensibly, or I guess maybe closer to 25 million, we were going to make up for, but. When we talk about the failure of the exchanges in terms of bringing the cost down, we're not talking about a huge number, relatively speaking, to the country of people.
Well, there are a number of people who do buy on the exchanges. About 6 million of them get subsidies, and most of the people buying on the exchanges do get subsidies. I think 87% of those buying last year got a subsidy. So most of them have need for a subsidy, judging
right.
by their income. The rest of us are in Medicare or in military plans or have employer-provided coverage. And some of those regulations do apply relating to pre-existing conditions, apply in those markets as well. And so the major thing that this law did was to allow people who have pre-existing conditions to buy in the individual market very easily now, because that was a real problem we had before the law was passed.
And I mean, so that in the ledger of judging it, that's obviously a big positive, right? And things like rescission are, I mean, theoretically, this is the story that we're told, that our insurance product that we now have, that people, and particularly on the individual markets, but it seems to me across the board, is supposedly a better product. Is that true?
It's supposedly a better product in the sense that the benefits are more comprehensive, and there are the essential benefits, a coverage that a policy has to provide, and that is across the board. But I do want to make one point when you say they're better policies. It's what your definition of better is. Yes, you can get coverage for mental health coverage, for example, or they have to cover hospital surgeries and so forth. And all of that is true and to the good. But what has changed is that the cost sharing has increased a whole lot on policies all across the board. And that trend was going on before the Affordable Care Act was passed, slightly, but the ACA accelerated that trend when it sort of baked in what those amounts could be for cost sharing. And they are quite high. It's over $12,000 for a family policy this year. And so that means that a family buying on the exchange, if an insurance company wants to construct its policy to make people pay a lot of money out of pocket before insurance pays, they can make them pay over $12,000. And that is pretty steep.
That's the rub. I mean, that's ultimately the rub, right? I mean, supposedly we're getting better health insurance, but we're getting better health insurance because we're paying a lot more for it.
Well, you know, it's what better means to you is what it really comes down to. And I argue that many families really can't afford that. And some people are not buying because they're saying, you know, what, this isn't real insurance if I have to pay $8,000 out of pocket before I have insurance. And I've heard lots of consumers say that. So I think we really have to look at the definition of our terms here.
Yeah, well, all right, well, so what does better mean in that context? I mean, because, you know, one of the dilemmas, it seems to me, with insurance is that I think it's something 20% of the people bear 80% of medical costs in this country, right? And so I'm walking around with insurance. I think it's better because I'm only paying whatever it is, $50 a month. I mean, God, you know, we should be so lucky. But when I actually get hit by a bus, it turns out the insurance company says, well, you've gone over your lifetime limit or whatever it is. The insurance isn't very good. I don't really find that out until I get hit by a bus. That's why like these polls that say I like the insurance or I don't like the insurance are very sort of cagey, right?
Well, there are no lifetime limits anymore. That was eliminated a long time ago. That was one of the good things that this law did. But it, you know, in the end, it didn't affect all that many people anyway. But your point is about whether people like their policies or not. I think you have to use the policy before you know whether you like it or not. And, you know, many people have probably not used their policies yet because they're pretty new for a lot of people. So it's only when you have some sort of really bad illness and you try to collect on your policy and you find yourself with out-of-network providers, which may not be covered. Certainly in New York, you're not going to have benefits for out-of-network providers. And then you're going to find out that you may not have coverage for what you think you need. And another thing I want to point out about those kind of satisfaction polls is that in general, about two-thirds of the people who are respondents are generally satisfied or somewhat satisfied or very satisfied. So that's just sort of axiomatic of that, those kind of polls. So you have to kind of think about that in relation to what the numbers actually show.
So what would we do? I mean, in terms of defining, like, better health insurance, would it just come down to we would – it really comes down to sort of like cost sharing and premium cost, right? I mean, with the presumption that you're actually getting real health insurance.
Yeah, but everybody really needs to be covered, and we are still going to have 35 million people uncovered, even with this law. So we have to talk about better for whom. And in the countries that have universal, really universal coverage, everybody is covered.
Who are those 35 million that are not covered? I mean, that's the thing that I don't, I mean, we were sold, it seems to me, on the idea that this would be universal. And there was always sort of some talk, well, maybe there'd be 5, 7. But then all of a sudden, like the number of people who were going to be covered, it seemed to me when we started to see the actual numbers, seemed to be smaller. Because I kept hearing there are 45 million people uncovered who don't have health insurance in this country. This is in the run-up to the law. This is why we need to do that. Well, that's all well and good, but it doesn't even seem to me like the plan contemplated ever covering 45 million people. It seems like it contemplated best case scenario like 2020, 22 or something like that. Where, who are these other people?
Well, the numbers are there were 52 million people uninsured when the law was passed, and I think we have made some progress in covering more people. But the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which knows what it's doing in its estimation department, has now estimated that there will be 35 million people without health insurance. And, you know, some of those might be illegal immigrants, but certainly not all of them. There will be people who just have chosen not to buy it. And then there are a number of exemptions in the law. And so there will be a whole class of people who won't be getting coverage. The law was never intended to cover everybody.
Well, but that's what I'm curious. I mean, do we have like harder data on that? Like, I mean, I know that maybe 5 million of that 35 million, right, would be eligible for Medicare if the states had picked it up. Who are the other 30 million? Is it? I mean, are they undocumented? Are they? You say part of it is exemptions because they apparently they can't. Even with the
people who are too poor, you can get an exemption if you have financial hardships. People at the very bottom, people who just decide they don't want it. I mean, it can be all of those.
But wouldn't, if you're too poor, this is the part that I don't understand. If you're too poor for the subsidies, this I understand, you fall between some type of gap, right? Because if you're, if you make over 130% of poverty, 133% of poverty, but I mean, this is the part I don't understand. Then even with the subsidies, if it's over 9% of your income, you don't have to buy insurance. Is that right? I'm just trying to figure out who these people are.
There are exemptions in the law for people. There's a whole list of them for people who don't have to buy insurance. And many of them, if they've suffered a serious hardship within X months or something like that, are exempt from the penalties. And I think a lot of people will fall into that category. I think there are a lot of people in the Medicaid expansion or non-expansion now that may be falling into that category. I think there are some number of illegal immigrants here who are not getting coverage. I think those are basically the groups. I don't know, and I have not seen a breakdown of exactly who they are.
Yeah, that number is just, it's fascinating to me too. So where are we now? I mean, do we have any prospects of, you know, I certainly was someone who has always been in favor of single payer. And then as a fallback position, I had hopes about the public option, at least, you know, sort of crowding out some of the private players in the exchanges. And then we have these co-ops, which explain to people what the co-ops are and how they're doing.
The law set up an alternative to the commercial insurance carriers, these co-ops. And there were about 24 of them. I think there are 23 now. And I think there was one big failure in the Midwest at the beginning of the year. I think some
the law
of them
provided
are doing
startup loans essentially to these co-ops,
yeah,
because they had no cash when they started.
And some help for them, that's correct. And some of them are doing okay. Someone I was talking to yesterday said financials he had seen shows that some of them are struggling a bit. I think we still don't know how that's going to shake out yet. I mean, they're really just going into their, well, this year will be their third year in operation. We do know that in several markets, they have, they're very competitive. People have bought their policies, and in some cases, they have very, very large market shares, 70-80% of the market. And it tells me that many of those policies are very low price, and people are buying by price on the exchanges. There's no question about it. Price is really important. The premium is very important because they have to shoehorn that into a family budget, and that's really hard.
Right.
And so the co-ops are kind of trying to get those people into their fold. The big question is, and this sort of arose in the failure of the Nebraska-Iowa co-op earlier this year, that they may have priced their policies too low, and I think that the regulators are kind of worried about co-ops that are pricing too low, because there is such a thing in private insurance that if you price too low and you have a lot of customers come in and they are pretty sick, and since you have to take everybody now, no matter whether they're sick, dying, or whatever, you might end up with a whole lot of claims that are really going to hurt you in the long run. And by that, I mean they're going to affect your solvency.
And that is, and that's what the risk pool insurance or the risk pool insurance, or I think it was supposed to deal with. Yes, the first couple of years where this sort of shook out.
Well, what we have a whole bunch of risk pools going on here. I mean, the idea was that you would get a lot of sick people and well people into your mix, and you'd get enough well people, so that would balance that out in the aggregate. But in individual companies, some of the big companies who know how to do pricing really well and have a lot of claims experience, the big, big carriers, are not going to be hurt by that. But a small co-op that doesn't have a lot of experience and gets, you know, misses on what the price is, could be affected, and that's what happened to the Iowa co-op. They had a lot of sick people who came into the co-op seeking low-priced insurance. Those people had a lot of claims, and
wasn't there a provision where the federal government would basically for the first couple of years cover that because people didn't know how the risk pools were going to be made up? And I think at that point, the right was calling it a subsidy to the insurance companies.
Yeah, there are some provisions. There are risk corridors.
Risk corridors, yes.
Risk adjustment, and one more. And what that means is that there's been some protections, and that whole constellation, or most of that, not all of it, is going to go away by 2017. So I think we really won't know what's going to shake out for a couple more years yet. I don't think we know what rates are really going to be long term. I think we really don't know what those individual risk pools are going to look like. We may know more about it after the summer when some of the new monies get kind of moved around a bit under those protections. I think we might know some more by the end of the summer, but right now, at this moment, I don't think we know.
Well, I appreciate you walking us through this stuff. I would just prefer, frankly, at this juncture, let's just do a Medicare buy-in, and then ease ourselves into just Medicare for everybody.
Well, that was the plan originally when Medicare was passed, because Johnson was not able to get universal health care, even in 1965 with his great congressional skills. He couldn't get it, and everybody sort of thought that, well, all right, let's just do something for the old people and do something for poor people, then we'll be on our way. But obviously that didn't happen because the political winds in this country shifted. Certainly by 1980 they were shifting greatly. And so what happened is that we never really got to that stage. And when it appeared during the ACA debate that maybe this Medicare buy-in provision might make it, the industry got very concerned, and their lobbyists sent it on Washington to make sure that didn't happen. And so that didn't get very far at all.
I mean, so at the end of the piece, I mean, you essentially conclude this is better than nothing. And to a certain extent, I mean, it was that the choice? I mean, because it seems like, you know, the way that the industry has relentlessly chipped away at this and the different forces, I mean, was that the choice? I mean, was there really anything else on the table in any meaningful way? Or do we just have a system that is sort of fundamentally broken in some way that we cannot get? Johnson couldn't get it. Joe Lieberman made sure that we weren't going to get the buy-in.
That was a public option, wasn't it?
Well, I know Joe Lieberman used to favor 55 and over Medicare buy-in, and he decided, I think when it became clear that there was going to be a mandate on everybody, that the insurance company never need that. So,
yeah. Well, I think that in the end, I think that the supporters of the ACA framed the debate very narrowly. They came up with a very narrow way of trying to increase coverage. I think that was the goal. I think the goal was probably never universal coverage. I think it was incremental coverage. Let's try to cover a few more, a few more, and a few more, and see how far we get. And I think they believe politically that's all they could sell. And so I think that was the calculation they made. There was no other discussion of how we could use our employer-based system in ways that, say, the Germans or the Japanese do to actually really have universal coverage. That was never on the table. And so I
not even during the primary, not even during the Democratic primary, it seems.
No, well, not even before, not even in 2006 when all this was being decided. And I think that may have, they just didn't think very creatively. They thought what they could get. They thought in terms of what politically they thought they could get. And I think that on the Republican side, because, you know, initially their opposition, certainly during the debate, was, I would say, was kind of tepid. You know, they didn't like it, and Baucus couldn't get Republicans to sign on. But, you know, none of the vitriolic stuff at that point, that came much later. But my belief is that all of that has been very effective in pushing the framing of what we are willing to talk about or tolerate much further to the right. And I don't think that we're going to get anything to change in the foreseeable future. And I think that it will take something catastrophic before that happens. The discourse has been reframed, and the discourse has been reframed further and further to the right, which precludes any kind of discussion, I think, of a Medicare for all or a Medicare buy-in or anything like that. In fact, I think we'll be lucky to keep Medicare as a social insurance program in the next few years.
Interesting. Well, I hope you're wrong about that last part. And I hope you're wrong about the debate, too. Maybe who knows what the Democratic debates will bring with Bernie Sanders on the stage this year.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see and how far we're willing to sort of think about reframing the debate on our healthcare system. Things are really never static, I think, in any country or any discussion. And, you know, there's always possibility that things could change. But I think people have to sort of start from what we've got now and understand its shortcomings and then decide if they want something better.
Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and her piece is in Harper's Magazine, Wrong Prescription, The Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Boop, boop. All right, folks. Still have not customized that Skype sign. The list of things that I have to do. See, Michael says he doesn't need it.
I like customized. It.
There you go.
I think it works.
All right. This is what we need to do. Folks, you know, we are now posting our show regularly on Daily Kos. You can head over our handle on Daily Kos. Oddly enough, is the Majority Report. And so if you are a member of the Daily Kos community, by all means, give us a recommendation. Leave a comment. Maybe we'll start leaving polls. Do you think Republicans are bad? Yes or no? I don't know. Text 5321. Also, if you are on Reddit, we have our own subreddit. And we actually now, for a short period of time, have a vice president of subreddit relations. Noah, do you want to come to the microphone and just give us a quick rundown on what a subreddit is? This is the vice president of our subreddit relations. He's the only one who's got a corner office here, so he's going to take some minute to come out. Noah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Please tell us about the subreddit that you are vice president, that you've skyrocketed in this operation here.
Yeah. So essentially it's a small pocket of the internet community. And what we really want is to have the conversations that we have here keep going. So we want to see a lot of like internet posts and more people trafficking things, putting things they think are related to the Majority Report, maybe talking about shows after they're done. Yeah. Story suggestions, maybe keeping up your IMs afterwards. Like that's where they can go. So like, I think we can just like broaden our kind of internet appeal.
Thank you, Noah. It's nice to have some measure of competency in this
Vice President Intern Noah.
That's right.
Sure is nice to have some competency and emotional maturity around here.
That's right.
I agree. All the above.
Here we go. All right. So we're going to take a quick break. Folks, remember, it is your support that makes the show possible. Now we've got to pay a vice president. Fortunately, vice president rates are pretty low around here. Intern vice president.
I think I'm the only one who's actually given a form of payment to the vice president.
Oh, just you wait. No, it's going to...
More Jamaican patties on the way.
That's right. There's all sorts of... Like...
Oh, I don't know if you exactly give him payment, being that you also make him do push-ups.
That's for his
own
good.
All right, let's save this for the better half. We don't want to give it all away for free, guys. The bickering.
Matt's humor will not undermine the better half. Don't worry.
All right. All right, let's just stop. Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. You know where else you can get a program like this? Nowhere. All right. And we're going to working on this Obama interview. It could happen.
Really?
Could.
Maybe unlikely. We're actually making some progress, huh?
It could.
All right.
Folks, we rely on your support for 98.7% of the revenue of this program. Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, again, leave us a review on iTunes. Very helpful. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's great coffee. It tastes great. It's also, everybody involved gets paid a fair rate. That's why they call it fair trade. Maybe they should really call it fair rate coffee, but I'm not going to get into that. And you can get 10% off by using the coupon code MAJORITY. It's a win-win-win. Get the Majority Report blend, add another win, give it to a friend, add another win, see how this goes. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is go buy it at our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it. Buy your stuff. You don't notice a difference. We get a kickback. MajorityReportKickback.com. We're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me via the app, of course. See you later.